Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges.
Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and we have two guests today, one for each segment. Our first guest today is the director and producer, Wynette Yao, of District of Second Chances, which will have its world premiere at Dances with Films on December 3, 2023. Wynette Yao is an award-winning filmmaker who has produced, directed, and written films on subjects as wide-ranging as Egypt, tornadoes, bees, and bog mummies. She relishes storytelling that brings alive the human experience in history, science, social justice, and modern life. After a career making films for National Geographic Channel, Discovery, and the Smithsonian Channel, Yao joined FAM Foundation, a non-profit that advocates for criminal justice reform, as staff filmmaker. She has created videos, spots, and long-form documentaries highlighting the need for a more fair and effective justice system, including the award-winning Half of Us, The Vanishing Trial, Bronx Social Justice Matters Festival, and First Place Documentary Shorts. Yao's previous work includes Oceans at the Tipping Point, winner of the Innovation Award at the Blue Ocean Film Festival for Conservation International, and Who Betrayed Anne Frank, winner of the Gold Remy Award, World Fest Houston Film Festival for the Discovery Channel, just to mention two. Welcome, Wynette Yao, to The Reasonable Voices, and how are you today?
I'm doing so well. Thank you for doing such a great introduction.
Thank you for being on the show, truly. There are two things before we begin our conversation. There are a number of still photos in this film that we're talking about today by Richard Ross, and they're very impressive and certainly enhance the production itself. And secondly, a quote I want to start with, "Through raw, intimate human stories, this film shows us how Washington, D.C. has decided to welcome home a generation it once abandoned. Honest and hopeful, this film is guaranteed to soften hearts, lift spirits, and change minds." That's a quote from James Forman Jr., the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Locking Up Our Own. Wynette Yao, your film, District of Second Chances, follows a quest for redemption in Washington, D.C. Tell us a bit about your three men who are the focus of District of Second Chances: Anthony Pete Petty, Gene Dowling, and Coley LeVar Long. Why you chose them for this enlightening and challenging to the audience? Why were they your choices?
Well, we started shooting in June 2021, and the pandemic was still ebbing and flowing. So that made the whole world weird, and it also made it hard. Anthony Petty, or Pete, as he's called, was already out. He had been out for 6 months, which was still a short amount of time, but we could at least get to him and, you know, see how he was, And I was won over right away by his directness and authenticity. He was always willing to talk about everything and, you know, could come off as a very tough guy. Mm. And yet I always saw a very tender side to him for all the guys, I must say. And I think it's because they were at a exciting but vulnerable points in their life. Mm-hmm. I mean, Pete had been incarcerated for 30 years. So he was a man who had survived that time, but also was being reborn. So we follow him to see how that goes. And then Gene Downing was recommended to me by the group Free Minds, which does sends books and does writing workshops with incarcerated people. And they had indeed been corresponding with Gene. Gene is a spoken word poet, and he had been sending them many poems, and they had published some of them. And I thought that was very appealing that he kept creating even with no privacy and caught in a world where the best thing that could happen that day was to be let out of the cell for an hour. Mm. And that didn't always happen because it was a very violent prison. So they would constantly go into, you know, many day long, probably many week long lockdowns where, nope, you couldn't leave. That's all you had. So in this world, he had, you know, planted the flower of his creativity, and it was flourishing. And it was hard to get to him, because once someone's behind bars, it's very hard to have any communication. This is one reason why what happens in prisons is so hidden from us. You just don't see it. You just can't get to it. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't exactly have, you know, a welcome visitation day for people. And so I managed to speak to Gene by Zoom over the phone. It was tagged onto his session with his lawyer, which by law they're guaranteed a certain amount of time. And, you know, I thought he was very appealing. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we didn't know what would happen. The law that he was getting out on, the Second Chance Amendment Act, was pretty new. And I think he was maybe the third case to come up under the law. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Coley LeVar Long was brought to our attention by his lawyer, who works for the Second Look Project, which is a group of lawyers who are offering their services pro bono to the men who had the chance of applying under these laws. Because when the bills were passed, they didn't have any stipulation about how any would be able to use the law. And we all know lawyers are not cheap. And so there was a hole in groups like Second Look Project and Public Defender Service and a few other groups. In fact, many lawyers in D.C. are just mobilizing to offer their services. And so Destiny Fullwood was representing Coley LeVar Long, and she just wanted me to meet him and consider him. And I was definitely won over by his humor, and in addition to humanity. And that's how we found those three people.
All right. Well, I guess we should also mention how this all started. I mean, because I have to tell you, I write a lot politically, and I've often said to people, especially since Trump, don't tell us one day you didn't know what was going on. But I have to confess, I had no idea of anything like what your film describes to us. So I want to go back to this concept that a professor who was a Bush advisor, I believe GW, Professor John DeLulio, he created this, for lack of a better word, a proclamation of that black people were super predators. They were rapists, they were murderers, and this was in 1996. I'm just wondering what was going through his head. What prompted that? Does he have any excuse? Excuse is the wrong word, of course, but I mean, what, do you sit down one day and just decide to classify what you talk?
Yes. Well, there was a rise in crime at that time. And so he set out to explain it. He was not the only one to come up with this idea of super predators. There was at least one other man. I can't think of his name right now. But John DeLulio got very associated with this theory because he talked a lot about it. As you can see in our film, we have clips. Mm-hmm. If you dig into it, it's unfortunately based on some very simplistic thinking, which is that crime is rising. They could see a rise in crime happening in youth. And they said, because the population will keep growing, there's going to be a rise in youth who commit crime.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. And they didn't say it was only black youth, but somehow it turned into that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we know how that happens in the media, in people's assumptions. And so, it was probably not exclusively black kids, but it was just majority. This was what people were fearing, that black youth was doing this. And then, as you know from the film, in fact, the crime rate dropped.
Yes.
Shortly after, but nobody noticed. And the tragedy of it is it affected so many laws in our country that were passed on this premise that we have to stay safe by incarcerating the black, dangerous black youth, you know, very heavily, life sentences, put them away, and then we'll figure out why it's happening. And so they missed the fact that, well, it wasn't happening anymore. And unfortunately, those laws continue to this day. They're very hard to undo.
Yes, laws work that way generally. We also should mention, in all fairness, as I threw out G.W. Bush's name, Democratic politicians were also just touting whatever they read about good old Professor John DeLullo, so that it just perpetuated, and as you say, the media, of course. But let's get to why, because anyone can go, they can be horrified as I was as I watched your movie. Why is incarcerating black children as adults, let me say that again, black children as adults, so damaging for the society as a whole?
Well, as you know from what Professor Kristen Henning says in the film, District of Second Chances, adolescence is a crucial time in someone's development. People are making connections. They're trying to explore their identity. So often when someone gets locked up at that age, they obviously lose all their access to good influences. Often they don't even get to go to classes, although there were groups working on getting education into jails and prisons. But so they can be completely isolated with nothing to do except to learn about more crime. Richard Ross, you did an amazing job capturing what was happening with these youth in prisons. And District of Second Chances is really the story of what happened to these kids who were incarcerated at this time under the myth of being super predators. And we know that people age out of crime. You know, murder and drug arrest rates peak at age 19. We know from brain science, neuroscience has shown that the prefrontal cortex is not completely developed until age 25. And so big changes after that age that are not fairly addressed by someone having a life sentence.
And when we say a life sentence, I mean, there are examples of, again, in the film District of Second Chances we're talking about today, Carl Racine, former Attorney General of Washington, D.C., said that 14- and 15-year-olds were being put in prison for life. Now, I thought, by and large, we don't try children till they're 18 as adults, but this sounds like that was sort of thrown away with this whole predator thing. What happened with that?
Well, so under Title 16 of the federal law governing D.C., the U.S. Attorney's Office has the authority to charge and prosecute children as adults. That allows teens to be, or non-adults to be tried as adults. That's what happened, and that is still what's happening. So for violent crimes, really heinous crimes, what we think of as, you know, we have to stop this, we still will try a child as an adult.
Wow, I didn't know that. So it is true that in the 1960s and 70s, there was an average of 2 black children a year were sentenced to life in prison without parole, which is another layer of this. But by 1996, the average was more like 152 a year. And was the increase because of coming out with Super Predator, or which came first?
Oh, yes, this idea that they needed to be locked away. resulted in laws that were even stricter, and that resulted that gave way to the peak of the arrest of children.
Do you think that this may sound like a setup or a flippant or a silly question, but I couldn't help but wonder if this super predator proclamation out there, that it, do you think it still influences how the law, as or at least the police who are being violent with black young people, this is happening on and on and on. Do you think those two have any connection?
I personally do. And you can see Professor Henning in the film says, even to this day, when people think of crime or they're walking down a dark street, they think of a black person.
Hmm.
So I'm not an expert. She's more of an expert. But the fact that we had this phenomena was bound to influence so much, and in fact did.
And again, as we say, the media, of course, kept playing it over and over and over again. So until, and a lot of people still believe everything they see on television. I don't know why, but they do. I'm in television, and so I, you know, I'm going, wait a minute, but we won't go there. It's okay. I wonder, though, do you think Washington, D.C. is leading the nation in second chance laws?
I think that we unfortunately have come to another period where there's been a rise in crime rates, though it's fallen off in many cities. Washington, D.C. is still struggling with one. And so I think every time that happens, it creates an environment where some politicians and some people will say, we're not being tough on crime enough.
Mm-hmm.
And long sentences and, you know, more arrests and more jail time. It seems like it works, that equation, but in fact it's a false equation. And that was one of the greatest hopes as I made this film. I kept thinking, we have known that long sentences do not make us safer for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't made it into general public knowledge. And so if people can get one thing from this film, I hope they start to question that equation. Because criminologists have long known that extreme sentences do not make us safer. What makes us safer is the certainty of punishment and the swiftness of punishment, not the length of the sentence. Long sentences don't work for some of the reasons we already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
People actually age out of crime. They're mm-hmm. not the danger they might have been. So sentencing someone for life would probably only make sense in extreme cases. Obviously, someone pathologically dangerous, no, they need to stay in. But there's a majority of people who will mature if you give them a chance. And, you know, finally, people who are about to commit a crime, they're not thinking, you know, should I risk getting a 20-year sentence, a 30-year sentence? You know, maybe I shouldn't. It either happens in the on the spur of the moment, or it is something that they're just not thinking about at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've said that, of course, your film is really based on what's going on in Washington, D.C., because that's what this is about, the District of Second Chances. But even in Washington, D.C., the D.C. Council kind of has been resisting some of the things for second chance programs. Like, what is it, the not a moral balance, right? Can you talk to us a bit about that?
I don't believe that the D.C. Council is resisting, because they recently tried to extend the thinking behind second chances
mm-hmm.
to take it off an age limit of the crime having been committed before the age of 25, which is what it currently is, and broaden it to anyone who had served 15 years. And that's not to release them, but to give them a chance to say, look, I've changed. And that's usually a multi-year process as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they passed that law. Mayor Bowser vetoed it. And then Congress upheld it.
Mm.
So that's what happened there.
Okay. All right. Well, we are looking forward to the world premiere of District of Second Chances at Dances with Films. December 3rd, 2023. We've been talking to director Wynette Yao, and it's just so much more we could be talking about. We're going to leave some of that to discuss with our second guest, also involved with the film District of Second Chances as the cinematographer and editor. But before we go, two things. I'd like you to tell us how we can reach out to you and regarding the film, any social media, website, whatever that you wish to share. And then I'll ask you one last question, if I may.
Okay. Yes, we do have a website, which is districtofsecondchances.com. And there's a contact page on that. And we're also on Instagram, District of Second Chances, and Facebook, same name. So, yes, I hope that people will follow along and see how it does and get a chance to see it themselves.
I hope that, too, because it's eye-opening. It's shocking. It's unbelievable. And there are a lot of good people working to fix it, and still here we are. My last question, and I think you've just answered it, Wynette, but I'll ask it anyway. What do you want the audience to walk out of the theater thinking after they see your District of Second Chances?
I hope that the audience sees District of Second Chances and understands that there are human beings, complicated and very much like themselves, who get caught in these situations where they've done something bad, they're paying the consequences, and then they're trying to have a life and work their way out of it. It's very similar to the life arc that we all have, really. You know, we grow up, hopefully we develop ourselves. Of course, we all had a different set of circumstances to begin with.
Mm.
And I really learned how behind every crime, there is a story of sadness and poverty and dysfunction. And then I also hope that people walk away from this documentary and think, people really can change.
Yes.
I learned that myself. You can do something, you can hear about someone doing something and say, and write them off and think, wow, that person doesn't deserve to be, you know, out here with us. And then you, you know, meet that person and you can see they have changed vastly. It is capable. It's part of what we're developing. We humans are capable of.
Yes. You make an excellent point. I think if everyone listening and all the people you know, if you were to ask yourself and ask them, have you ever done anything you're ashamed of doing? You know, and there it is. They don't even have to answer. Their face will tell you, and you will know too. Look in the mirror sometimes and just ask yourself, have you ever done something you're ashamed of? That was a crime or not a crime. And, you know, ponder on that. Well, we have to go because we do want to get to our second guest also, as I said, working with Wynette Yao, the director and producer of District of Second Chances. And that guest is the cinematographer and editor. So we're going to say goodbye to you, Wynette, but we hope to have you on the show again because there's much more to discuss. And I'm so glad you were here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed that.
Okay. Bye now. And all the best.
Okay. Same to you.
Hi, I'm Wynette Yao, the director and producer of District of Second Chances.
And I'm Travis Edwards, the cinematographer and editor.
Our documentary follows three men from D.C. who are convicted of murder and sentenced to life.
Decades later, second look laws give them the chance to win their freedom. But as the film shows, nothing is guaranteed.
I was sentenced with life without parole. When they told me I was going to die in prison.
A 16-year-old kid put in a environment like that, in this off-the-wall violence, I mean stabbings and murders and rape, I always felt like I would never make it out. So I had to make a transition within myself.
Brains develop over time, and my goodness, people change.
And our laws help show that possibility of change is real.
When I seen my son walk out the door, my heart dropped to my feet. I knew that it was a God. And God do second chances.
Find out what happens at the world premiere of District of Second Chances, a production of Fan Foundation at the Dances with Films Festival in New York City. Reserve your tickets now for Sunday, December 3rd at danceswithfilms.com. And for more information, check us out at districtofsecondchances.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, and our second guest today is cinematographer and editor for District of Second Chances, Travis Edwards. Travis, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm having a wonderful day. And I'm so happy to be talking to you and Wynette. We talked to Wynette in the first segment as the director and producer, and we're talking to Travis Edwards in this segment, the cinematographer and editor of District of Second Chances, which is an amazing documentary. Trust me, it will change your life. And if it does not change your life, well, then you haven't been listening. That's all I can say. But let's tell you a little bit about our second guest today. The cinematographer and editor of District of Second Chances is Travis Edwards, who's on the phone with us. With work ranging from commercial to documentary to narrative, Travis's focus has always been on the impact of storytelling through video. His award-winning work has taken him across the country and has involved everything from filming undercover in puppy mills, remember that, to filming politicians in D.C. Travis Edwards strives to present ideas and stories through innovative and engaging content that can help improve people's lives. What more are we here for? Certainly, we artists. District of Second Chances is a film that follows a quest for redemption in Washington, D.C. Thanks to Second Chance legislation, three men who were sentenced in their youth to life in prison, that's when they were children, to life in prison, have the chance to plead for release. Through heartfelt, gritty stories, we follow their journeys, the journeys of Anthony Pete Petty, Gene Dowling, and Coley LeVar Long. So, I do want to stress, I told Travis this before we came on air, we talked so much about the subjects of this, and we will do that. It's so important to hear his point of view on this. But I also want to mention my impression as a director of the filming of this. Well, Travis, tell me, as a cinematographer and editor, before we get to the subject matter, what drove your eye? What did you see that made you do these incredible segments that are so full of hope when they're talking about some of the most horrible things I've ever heard that humans can do to humans? There's your question. You run.
Well, that's a big question there.
Yes.
Yeah, we wanted to, with this film, capture, I mean, what these guys went through. And so we also, when we started filming, we had very little access. We started filming in 2021, and so COVID is still rampant, and so we tried to film at the D.C. jail for a long time. We kept getting denied access. Two of the guys were incarcerated when we started filming, and so we just couldn't. We were basically just doing Zoom interviews, and so Zoom interviews don't make the best documentaries, and so we really pushed ourselves to find creative ways to visually tell their stories even though they were still incarcerated. And so we did that through a bunch of different ways, but I mean, as documentaries typically go, you kind of sketch out the ideas that you want to get, and then you shoot it, and then those change, and then you do the editing and it changes again. And so we knew that if we were just showing static Zoom interviews, that wasn't going to make a compelling documentary at all.
And so we ended up with quite a few professionals in other professions who were certainly confirming that what these filmmakers were doing so well artistically was actually pretty gritty and horrible and inhumane facts about ourselves. Travis, about these men who were boys legally when they were arrested, I wonder, you know, Anthony Pete Petty, at age 16, was sentenced to life in Lorton Reformatory in Virginia. And I'm just wondering, Pete served in over 20 prisons in America because when Lorton closed, what happened to the people, the prisoners who were in Lorton? And Pete was one of them.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, we tried to embrace the DC-ness of telling these guys stories because the laws that eventually, affect the storyline, they're very DC-specific. And so DC's an unusual place for all sorts of reasons, but one of the reasons is that there's no federal prison here, and so people who are charged for federal crimes, because we're not an actual state, they used to get sent to Lorton, which is just a little bit away in Virginia, but then Lorton started closing in the 90s, and it took a little bit for them to do that, but in the process of it closing, all of the people who were incarcerated there just got sent across the country. And so we note that in the documentary, but then I mean, Pete afterwards has said that there's no apparent rhyme or reason where you're sent to, and so you some days would wake up and they say, hey Pete, we're shipping you, get on a bus, we're taking you somewhere else, and you wouldn't even know where you're going when you're on the bus. And so just terrible things for people to be able to stay connected with their families, with their communities, with anybody. You're just completely cut off. And so all of the guys were wound up moving across the country numerous times. But Pete was in for the longest of the three guys that we followed, so I mean, my goodness, he was just jerked all across the country.
And which one of the guys were, he went to prison young, and his son was born after he was in prison, and then he came home, and 13 months after he came home and spent time with his son was imprisoned. How do people, and here's a cinematography question, because I know how camera people think, how do you shoot something that shows that, because you did. You captured it, man. You captured it. How do you get behind a camera and look through that lens and capture the fact that a man who was too young to go to jail for life, who managed to get out after 2 years, then has 13 months with his son, and then his son gets sent to prison? How do you capture that? Tell us, because you did it.
Well, I think I'm glad that conveyed. I guess the documentaries, a lot of that starts before we even start filming. And so the person you're talking about is Eric Weaver, and we do a short story in there about him. But it took the trust of him to let us into his house to film with him, to tell his story, to be open about it. I mean, these are incredibly difficult, you know, life-defining things that they're talking about there. And just the honesty and vulnerability they talked about. I mean, I commend all of the people who are in the documentary, because, again, these are very difficult subjects. But it also took us, you know, establishing dialogue with them beforehand, us being open about what we were doing, and then just the trust that they were able to give us of, you know, saying, hey, Eric, you're now thinking about your son who was murdered, and then can you, you know, we're going to film some shots of you while you're processing this. And so just that transparency, I think, in getting people, you know, we didn't stage anything, we didn't, you know, tell anybody to act in a certain way. And so I think it speaks a lot to all of the people who are in the documentary that they let us come in and let us sort of explore how to tell those things visually.
You know, that's an excellent point. Thank you for mentioning that. People who are not actors, who have been through so much trauma, and for you guys to get them to sit and talk about it as they do in this, they tell stories that I think most people would want to hide or to never speak of again, and yet you get them to confess on camera. I think that, as you're right, that speaks well of everybody. I wonder about some of the people, for instance, Mark C. Howard at Georgetown University Prisons and Justice Initiatives says America has a draconian penal system. Hundreds of thousands of people with life sentences. Now, did he say anything more than that off camera? Because that was powerful enough, but I'm just curious. What was that like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mark Howard and everyone at PJI is a branch of Georgetown is called. I mean, my goodness, they're such incredibly hardworking people who helped. I mean, they helped with the passage of the Second Look Laws that were obviously the crux for the documentary. I mean, just a wealth of knowledge, expertise, and experience. And yeah, I mean, my goodness, he was just a trove of information to talk to off camera as well. And we were happy to have him in the documentary and to feature some of the work that he's doing. But I mean, it's tricky to any time that Wynette and I have ever talked about, you know, we had fun making this, or, you know, oh, good, I'm glad the sequence came. It's, you know, we know what the cost was for us to be making this documentary. And so hearing some of the stats that Mark's able to bring up, or just any of the numbers, or hearing that Pete was moved to over 20 different prisons across the country, I mean, it's very easy to forget that these are humans. And saying 100,000 people are serving life sentences right now, that's 100,000 people. These aren't just numbers or statistics. And so even though we clearly use numbers and statistics at different times in the movie, I think that we kept trying to just get back to the humanity of this.
Yes.
And just what it's like to be talking about people and not just numbers on a page.
You know, and you're absolutely right to make that point. I mean, Gene Downey, 82 years to life, released under the Second Chance Laws, which we should talk about a bit, after serving 21 years. Isn't he the one that could not be released because you had to have committed the crime before you were 18? Is that right? If I'm remembering correctly. And he was 19. And he was 19, so he wasn't eligible to get out. But the law has since changed. Things have evolved. Tell us about that, the age limit and so forth.
Yeah, well, we, again, saying that we use some of these stories, we were generously granted the transparency of people's stories to convey these things. And so we talked about the passage and the expansion of the second look laws through Gene's story because he barely missed the cutoff. He was just a little too old for the first round of this, the second look laws that came through in D.C. And so we explore what that meant to him and his family when they increased the age of eligibility so that people like Gene could be eligible to have their cases looked at again. And it's, I mean, when you see Gene and you meet him in person, and hopefully we showed him the documentary, you think, like, I can't believe that an arbitrary cutoff date of, you know, because he was 1 month too old here, that meant that he wouldn't be able to be reunited with his family. He wouldn't be able to be doing any of the amazing work that he's doing now that he's free.
And that's a good point to make. He does a lot for the community now.
It's, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, all the guys who we were, again, fortunate enough to be involved with this, they're all just doing incredible, incredible work.
And they certainly have a sense of urgency about it, as we see in the film, because they know what the alternative can be.
Yeah, and I think he talks about it in the documentary where what was he, 46 when he was released from prison? I think I'm getting that right. And he went in when he was 16. So, yeah. I mean, I could not imagine looking back at my life and saying the age of 16 to 46, you just disappear at being out in society and that you're forced to, you know, do as much as you can with inside prison walls.
And one of the most human moments in, you know, because you've been stressing that, you want us to remember they're people, not just statistics. One of the most revealing human moments that you got on camera, driving in the car, and the entire neighborhood, everything he knew, everything had changed. How do you get back that life? I guess you answer that for me. I have a thought, but I want to hear what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough. I mean, we've been able to spend time with people who've been out of prison for years, and it's still difficult. I mean, the world's changed a lot, especially based on these guys going to prison in the 90s, you know, so the 90s to the early 2000s. I mean, my goodness, the world's changed a lot. And so, yeah, we've seen it, you know, everything, the visual things of, like, you know, the buses look different, or that intersection looks different, or there's a building there that didn't used to be there, but... Mm. There's a brief scene towards the end when one of the guys is getting a sort of like crash course on computers.
Yes.
And then watching his face when, you know, things that we would assume of like, oh yeah, just log in your email. Mm. I was like, well, like, what's email? What do you mean log in? How do I
know?
And it's like, oh right. We're starting from, if you just assume that all that memory that you have is just zapped away about computers and technology and you're trying to hit the ground running, my goodness, that's an uphill battle.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, hopefully we were able to show that a little bit, too, that it's not, oh, okay, you got out of prison, everything's just totally fine now. It's like, no, you're building up your entire life again.
No, you made that very clear, and that's why I asked the question again, because you being the editor and the cinematographer, you made that so clear in so many of those shots. The overriding story, of course, is all the horror of this and so many being ignorant of it and not trying to stand by your side and all the other people in the organizations that you had to work with to get this District of Second Chances on film so more people could know about it. By the way, we should mention District of Second Chances will have its world premiere at Dances with Films on December 3rd, 2023. When I was watching your film and when I asked the question just now of you, how do people get back that life? And I guess the best way is to look forward, which is what they're doing and what you're helping us to realize they're doing and maybe to reach out and be some help to them. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, again, speaking of the honesty that all of the people in the documentary, you know, had about everything, I also thought was very refreshing that even though we didn't show graphic depictions of crimes or anything like that, all the guys talked about it and they were open and nobody was denying what they did. And so I think that as far as the, if we're looking back or looking at the future, I think there's, all of the guys have a clear acknowledgement and understanding that they did something bad and they did something that deserved consequences. But when we say that the consequence for doing something when you were a teenager is paying the price with the rest of your life, I mean, that's a lot to give up there. And so I think we've really just tried to show that that these guys aren't running away from anything that they did, and that they're taking responsibility for their actions. But when that is saying life sentences and that you're never going to be able to spend a, you know, a free second outside of a prison, that's a pretty steep consequence there. And it's also completely minimizing any sort of change that people can undergo.
And you know, child psychologists now know that we are not fully developed before 18. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, we tell other stories in the documentary, but it's largely the story of the three guys. And so also looking at what the work that they had to put in to even be eligible for these laws, to, you know, to be able to go in front of a judge and petition their case. I mean, that's just an incredible amount of work that they put in. But knowing that, I mean, Pete, for example, he went to prison at age 16 with a life sentence. And when you're 16 and you're going into a federal prison, you get sent into solitary confinement. And so he spent the first several years of incarceration in solitary confinement. The degree of severity there, of saying, okay, you're 16, you came from a really tough area, you've gone through a lot of stuff already in your life, and then now you're going to go to solitary confinement for several years. Every word that Pete said to us, you know, as a free man, to me, I just find to be so incredibly impressive. And it speaks so much to me of just how much we all can change to see that he went through what he's gone through in the prison system and then is able to come out and be a, you know, like happy, optimistic, and incredibly inspiring person to me. It's just so amazing.
Exactly. Is it because the prison system really has no facility, no imagination as the system exists, so they simply put them in solitary confinement, assuming that in that way they keep them at least safe from the population that's over 21 years old? What do you think?
No, I think that's the reason initially why, say, Pete was sent to solitary confinement, because he was too young and it would be too dangerous for him to be in general population. But when you look at just what that robs from a 16-year-old to spend the next several years of their life in solitary, I mean, it's remarkable that anybody's able to come out of that.
Exactly. I guess that's one of the reasons federal prison systems are the most violent confinement possible. That was said in your documentary, District of Second Chances. Why are federal prison systems the most violent confinement?
Well, when you look at any progressive country's prison models, so it's like people always point to like Scandinavian prisons, it's completely different. It makes the U.S. look like an old like diesel bus can be like sitting next to a brand new electric car. And so it's a lot of policies are very slow moving. Any sort of change is very slow moving. And so even looking at the laws that the guys in the documentary went in on in the 90s, they were incredibly harsh, like ultimately just like racially charged laws and just things that don't make a lot of sense today. But those take so long to change. And so for me, at least when I look at the violence in the federal prison system, to me, it's a lot of it is just these old, outdated things that just haven't been updated or haven't been changed. And a lot of that is the length of the sentence, the age of the sentencing, and just all sorts of factors that create this perfect storm of violence.
You make the point, too, in your answer, that the super predator, this myth that was just made up and then plastered on young people, especially people of color, the guy who proposed that took it back and said, okay, well, you know, it was a mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we look at the rates of people who are going to prison, and then, I mean, even today, that we're talking about laws that happened over 30 years ago that we're still seeing the ripples and the consequences of, just these incredibly racially charged things where a lot of it is just kind of looking to make people disappear. And so just like overgeneralization, stereotypes, but then the easiest thing to do is say, oh, okay, people who look like this seem like they're committing crimes, so let's just get rid of them. And then that's effectively what a lot of these over-sentencing laws did. And it's just, it's obviously, you know, brutal to the people on the receiving end of that. And, you know, the communities and the family, or just every aspect of it is tough to swallow. But it's one of those things like, well, I mean, that's, you can like, unfortunately, logic out how it happened. which I think is incredibly depressing that we haven't been able to come up with other solutions other than just saying everyone who looks like this is probably a criminal, so let's just over-sentence them.
And that's exactly what the super predator theory was. Let's try an easy question. What's the difference between second chance laws and the Second Look Project?
Oof, so the Second Look Project is a specific group of lawyers in D.C. who have been helping people get out on the second look laws. But I started asking everybody, like pre-roll or after interviews, like, so can you explain us to this, like just the names of these things?
Yes.
Because there's second look laws, but then there's second look legislation, there's second chance laws, and then the specific D.C. one is IRA, or the Incarceration Reduction Amendment Act. And so we talked to a couple of the experts, and then I would ask them, like, so how do you refer to this? Like, oh, we use them all. Like, wait, really? Like, yeah, they're interchangeable, but they're not interchangeable. So that's why we just try to use an umbrella of just referring them to second chance laws.
And there's one that I really love. It has a long title, and it ends with returning citizens. And I just thought that's great, because that's another aspect of this that affects people who are in prison for lose their voting rights.
Yeah, the National Association for the Advancement of Returning Citizens.
Now, you know, the fact that we have to have an organization named that is a sad thing. But the fact that they knew we have to say all of this so people understand what we're dealing with. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, most people who are currently incarcerated will be released one day. So over 95% of people who are currently incarcerated will be returning citizens. And so, you know, obviously that could be a short sentence or a long sentence. And the documentary, District Second Chances, we focus on people who have life sentences or effectively life sentences. But I mean, yeah, that's something that I think that a lot of us, we haven't been directly impacted by incarceration, that we know the consequences of what it's like to take somebody away from society and then not give them tools or make education difficult or just the enormous difficulty that it is to be incarcerated away from your family, everyone. And then all of a sudden say, okay, now go figure the rest of your life out. You're free from prison now. And just seeing that uphill battle there, that it's, I mean, there's a bunch of amazing organizations and groups that can help people, but you have to know where they are if you're, you know, we filmed this in Washington, D.C., so there's a number of amazing organizations here, but not everybody's from Washington, D.C. Not everybody's going to have that infrastructure to be able to lean on when they need it.
Yes. It's been an amazing conversation, and I greatly appreciate both you and Wynette being on the show. The world premiere of District of Second Chances will be presented at Dances with Films on December 3rd, 2023. And so, Travis, how do we reach out? How do we get tickets?
Yeah, well, the best way to get all the info, because as you know, with films these days, it all changes quickly.
Yes.
It's going to be on the website, districtofsecondchances.com. And then there there's links to all the social media handles for the film. And then that's where we're going to keep updating screening links. And we're submitting to a good number of festivals. And so hopefully there will be screenings near you.
Excellent. You as a cinematographer, what do you want the people who sit in that dark auditorium among some strangers and watch your visual work, what do you want them to take home?
We would hope that people will leave just knowing that people are capable of change. We highlight people who went through incredibly difficult situations and were able to come out the other side of it due to a lot of work that they put into themselves and their lives and their family, maintaining those relationships. And so we're just hoping to show just a small snapshot of what that looks like when people show that they're capable of making change and becoming, I mean, I guess they were before, but I mean, just being able to thrive, given the opportunity.
Okay. District of Second Chances, world premiere at Dances with Films, December 3rd, 2023. We have had two amazing conversations today with two amazing artists who have brought us some truth. Travis Edwards, thank you so very much for being on the show, and thank you for all the work, truly, all the artistic work, the creative vision that you brought to this District of Second Chances film.
Well, thank you so much, and it was a pleasure to talk to you as well.
Absolutely, Travis. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you.
And now, enjoy Watchfire Music featuring vocal artist Jenny Burton singing Tear Down the House from Is Anybody Listening?
Tear it up,
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the Reasonable Voices heard round the world. Presidential bookends, John F. Kennedy and Joe Biden, crying out, "Wake up!" I write to all Americans under 50 years old, pleading on behalf of all Americans under 30 years old, who don't know the trouble we and they will see if we fail to unite to actually embody the truths we've claimed to be since Lincoln's emancipating Gettysburg Address. First, our current financial truths. 1. Inflation at lowest point in 2.5 years. 2. Unemployment rate below 4% for longest time since 1960s. 3. American economy defies recession predictions. Yet, with our post-Watergate loss of faith in government, most Americans are in voter accountability denial regarding the governors, members of Congress, and presidents we elect. We, 2023 Americans, need to recapture the best within us to alleviate both our inner turmoil for reality check on our individual responsibility for that turmoil. Perhaps President Kennedy's physical, intellectual, and political courage might inspire us to thy own constitution be true. 1. August 1943, saving his crew after PT-109 was sunk by enemy destroyer. 2. April 1961, endured CIA betrayal. 3. October 1962, saving the world from Cuban nuclear missile crisis despite General Curtis LeMay and others disobeying his orders. Yes, Joe Biden isn't as youthful, witty, or charismatic as our 35th, 46-year-old president, but despite being born with a stutter, the death of his first wife and daughter, and the loss of his 46-year-old son, Beau, to brain cancer, our 46th president remains an intellectual, savvy, emotionally calm, and politically steady negotiator with a respectful embrace of both constitutional law and his Roman Catholic faith in the face of America's enemies within and the foreign demagogues they choose to imitate. And like President Carter and Clinton, President Biden remains committed to a two-state solution in the Middle East. In the 1860s, Lincoln was challenged to save America. In the 1960s, Kennedy was challenged to save the entire world. And both made the ultimate sacrifice to fulfill their oath to do so. These presidents earned our respect, gratitude, and hail to the chief. In sharp contrast, the 6 January 2021 domestic terrorism by gullible MAGNA insurrectionists programmed to destroy American democracy stains our American dream with right-wing religious hypocrisy in a faux patriotic cesspool too akin to that of ordinary men who were willing to shoot German Jews to camouflage their own cowardice. It is for honest, reasonable voting patriots to alleviate our inner turmoil by exorcising from our nation's bowels any violent pretense of American patriotism. Like President Kennedy, it could be said that America is in danger of receiving the last rites again. Not because of the age of President Joe Biden, who clearly recognizes the humanitarian pragmatism of the world's two most powerful economies and militaries needing to communicate, if not for world peace, at least for global coexistence. Nonetheless, as Pennsylvania's John Dickinson said, most men with nothing would rather protect the possibility of becoming rich than face the reality of being poor. In other words, when easy access to guns is our default choice against real or imagined economic fear-driven anger, America reaps the futility of divorcing "ask what you can do for your country" to wed itself to leaders who rant that we can gain the entire world without losing our national soul to self-destruction. 2023 third-party candidates and non-voters are shoving American democracy under the boot of an old-time religion demonically twisted by corporatism's bottom line and the corrupted political egos it rents. On 11 October 1963, 42 days before President Kennedy was shot to death in Dallas, Texas, he wrote a National Security Action Memoranda, number 263, NSAM 263, titled South Vietnam, stating his intention for a complete withdrawal of America's 17,000 advisors in South Vietnam. Had President Lyndon Baines Johnson not ignored it, there would have been no American Vietnam War, no 58,220 military deaths, no POW John McCain, no Kent State, and no divided America based on youth versus experience. Time is running out for American voters to keep an essential promise: unedited education, unburned books, and unlimited intellectual curiosity for the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Imagine the oldest democracy in the world failing to rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, because the youngest voters among us betrayed the future of Americans younger than they. Until Americans of every race, color, creed, and age vote, there can be no "thank God Almighty, we are free at last, home of the brave." Until all Americans vote to preserve, protect, and defend all of our history, health care needs, and books, there will be no land of the free. Until legal voters 18 and older actually vote, America's next moment is not guaranteed. There are, of course, many things in life we cannot change, but nothing we cannot change if first we re-engage peace through civility and mutual respect. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.